Hi, Dave Emery here. This is For the Record program number 1058, The Christian West, Contextual Foundation of the Jim D. Jamiel Interviews. This is being recorded on February 26th of the year 2019. I want to apologize if I'm a little bit, if an edge is missing. I've got a little bit of a cold. Not bad, but it is, it is doing what colds do. And so if I'm not reading or pronouncing quite as crisply as I am accustomed to doing, there is a reason for that. Well, so a couple of additional apologies. Much of the material that I will be presenting on this program and perhaps in the next program, I have to weigh this, will be by way of repeat because I have presented much of this in past programs. Also, it might be perhaps misleading to talk about this as the contextual foundation of the Jim D. Jamiel Interviews. I believe that is accurate in some important ways for newer listeners or people perhaps listening for the first time. I did a 25-hour series of interviews with Jim D. Jamiel, the author of, among other titles, Destiny Betrayed, about the Jim Garrison investigation of JFK's assassination. Those are For the Record programs numbers 1031 through 1056, excepting For the Record 1039, which, due to a technical difficulty in the studios that precluded conducting a telephone interview, was recorded like this program is being recorded in the studio. There were a couple of items among the many, many important elements in Jim D. Jamiel's book Destiny Betrayed that I thought bore some not only rehashing, but some rumination in the context of some of the important things that I have spoken of in the past. In particular, when we were talking about the curriculum vitae, the CV of Clay Shaw, the primary defendant in Jim Garrison's investigation, an individual with a long history and involvement in the CIA. We were talking about the involvement of Clay Shaw with Permindex. That is an intelligence front that was inextricably linked with not only international fascism, but many of the elements of what I have referred to as the underground Reich. Specifically, the Permindex was bankrolled by the Schroeder Banking Corporation, whose scion was inextricably linked with the Baron Kurt von Schroeder, was inextricably linked with the SS. In the very first archive show, Uncle Sam and the Swastika, recorded on May 23rd of 1980, I went into the Schroeder Bank and the Sonderkonto S in the Schroeder Bank. That was an account that was used to finance the day-to-day activities of the Third Reich, and in return, the contributors to that fund, the financiers and industrialists, got the pick of the Nazi slave labor pool for use in their various commercial enterprises. Alan Dulles was inextricably linked with the Schroeder interests and was also very close to Clay Shaw. Alan Dulles, of course, not only a member along with his brother John Foster Bullis of the pivotally important Sullivan and Cromwell law firm, but he was a key U.S. intelligence officer for the OSS, the Office of Strategic Services, and also then became head of the CIA for many, many years. Another thing that I thought was very interesting in the Jim DiGiamio interviews, again, a very important book with many, many important elements in it. When talking about Clay Shaw and his efforts, along with David Ferry, with Freeport Sulfur, there was discussion that I will reiterate of Clay Shaw and David Ferry operating in connection with Canadian nickel interests who were bringing nickel from Cuba for use in various industrial considerations. This was going to be used by Freeport Sulfur in some of their operations in New Orleans. Freeport, at this point in time, the U.S. no longer had industrial links, commercial links, with Castro's Cuba, but Canadian nickel interests still did. And I thought that was more than a little interesting, because when John Foster Dulles, again, the brother of Alan Dulles, the man who was Secretary of State for Dwight D. Eisenhower when Alan Dulles headed up the CIA, when John Foster Dulles was hammering together the IG Farben Chemical Company and its attendant cartel connections, which gave it tremendous international influence, it was the links of, I believe it was International Nickel, I will talk about that, in New Jersey, and its Canadian Nickel Cartel Associates that basically gave IG Farben a pivotal interest in the nickel cartel. Nickel is very important for the manufacturing of armored plate and stainless steel, and I thought that perhaps ruminating about that and reviewing some of John Foster Dulles's, reviewing his work on behalf of the IG Farben and the nickel cartel, including Canadian nickel interests, might be worthwhile. Also, Jim DiGiamio wrote about Clay Shaw being a friend of Hjalmar Schacht. That's Hjalmar Horace Greeley Schacht, an individual we have spoken about many times. He was Adolf Hitler's first finance minister and a close associate of John Foster Dulles and Alan Dulles, and one of the individuals involved with hammering together the corporate links with the U.S. that ultimately permitted American capital to play a significant, decisive factor in the Nazi industrial and military machines. In AFA 37, and again in For the Record 1009, I discussed the concept of the Christian West. This was a plan supposedly never realized, which would have permitted Nazi Germany to ally with the U.S. and Britain in a military alliance against the former Soviet Union. Heinrich Himmler, among others on the Nazi side, was an advocate of a separate peace with the Western Allies, which then would have resulted in a military alliance between the U.S. and Britain and perhaps France against the former Soviet Union. That did not take place formally. Martin Bormann, however, far more important in the Nazi hierarchy, had the idea of secreting Nazi assets abroad and having the Nazi Party go underground and in turn continuing the main elements of the Nazi operation underground and abroad. I believe that ultimately the Christian West concept was realized and that basically an underground Reich, literally a Third Reich gone underground with both the economic, corporate, and cartel connections of the Bormann organization and the intelligence and military elements of the remarkable Reinhard Gehlen spy outfit fused together with a renaissance Nazi leadership in Germany, albeit a behind the scenes, at least up to a point, Nazi leadership in Germany. They were forged with the CIA and with NATO in what I believe was the realization of the Christian West concept. I'm going to present elements of review in this and perhaps the next program. I want to apologize again to veteran listeners because much of this will be by way of review, but I think with what is going on in the world, and again, moving to very important details in the Diogenial text, and I should stress that I am speaking here for myself and not for Mr. Diogenio. I think the Clay Shaw, David Ferry, Canadian Nickel links on behalf of Freeport Sulphur, and also the Clay Shaw, Permindex, Kurt the Schroeder, and Hjalmar Schacht connections are worth taking into account in connection with the Christian West.
You're listening to Dave Emery's For the Record. Long article-length descriptions of the For the Record programs are available at spitfirelist.com, also featuring information that wasn't in the original program due to the limitations of time.
I'm going to open this program with what I closed the previous broadcast with, and that is an excerpt from a book by Colonel L. Fletcher Prouty, an Air Force colonel who set up the focal point networks for Alan Dulles. These were networks within other U.S. government agencies, including the Pentagon, which were in fact administered by Alan Dulles and gave Alan Dulles and the CIA very important controlling influence in other U.S. government agencies, including the Pentagon. In a book called JFK, the CIA, Vietnam, and the Plot to Assassinate John F. Kennedy, by Colonel Prouty, published in hardcover by Skyhorse Publishing, who also published Destiny Betrayed, this copyright 2011 by Colonel Prouty. There is a passage that indicates that, in fact, the alliance between the U.S. and also apparently elements of British intelligence had actually occurred well before the incorporation of the formal historical incorporation of the Reinhard Gehlen spy outfit, which occurred after the conclusion of hostilities in Europe during World War II. Reading now from Prouty's JFK, the CIA, Vietnam, and the Plot to Assassinate JFK. However, even before the surrender of Germany and Japan, we began to hear the first rumblings of the Cold War. The Office of Strategic Services, parenthetically, that was the U.S. World War II Intelligence Service, and particularly its agents Frank Wisner and Alan W. Dulles in Zurich, nurtured the idea that the time had come to rejoin selected Nazi power centers in order to split the Western alliance from the Soviet Union. Rejoin, unquote, is the proper word in this case. It was the Dulles-affiliated New York law firm of Sullivan and Cromwell that had refused to close its offices in Nazi Germany after the start of World War II in 1939, even while Great Britain and France were locked in a losing struggle with Hitler's invading forces. Therefore, the Dulles OSS, quote, intelligence, unquote, intelligence contacts, unquote, in Nazi Germany during the war were for the most part German business associates with whom he was acquainted. This last sentence again, because this really embodies much of the focus of this program and perhaps much of the next. Therefore, the Dulles OSS intelligence contacts in Nazi Germany during the war were for the most part German business associates with whom he was acquainted. On August 23, 1944, the Romanians accepted Soviet surrender terms, and in Bucharest, the OSS rounded up Nazi intelligence experts and their voluminous Eastern European intelligence files and concealed them among a trainload of American POWs who were being quickly evacuated from the Balkans via Turkey. Once in, quote, neutral, unquote, Turkey, the train continued to a planned destination at a site on the Syrian border where it was stopped to permit the transfer of Nazis and POWs to a fleet of U.S. Army Air Force planes for a flight to Cairo. I was the chief pilot of that flight of some 30 aircraft and was stunned by the discovery of two things I would never have suspected. A number of the Americans had had one or both legs amputated at the knee by their Balkan captors, solely for the purpose of keeping them immobile. And concealed among these POWs were a number of Balkan Nazi intelligence specialists who were being taken out of the Balkans ahead of the Soviet armies by the OSS. Again, this is August of 1944. As far as, going, continuing with Pravi's account, as far as I know, this was one of the first visible clues to the emergence of the East-West Cold War structure, even while we and the Russians were still allies and remained partners in the great struggle against the Germans. It was this covert faction within the OSS, coordinated with a similar British intelligence faction and its policies, that encouraged chosen Nazis to conceive of the divisive Iron Curtain concept to drive a wedge in the alliance with the Soviet Union as early as 1944 to save their own necks, to salvage certain power centers and their wealth, and to stir up resentment against the Russians even at the time of their greatest military triumph. I was only a pilot on that flight and in no way involved in the diplomatic intricacies of that era, but I have always wondered whose decision it had been back in mid-1944, a year before the end of World War II, to override the present alliances and to initiate a split between the West and our wartime partner, the Soviet Union, while we were still firm allies. Indeed, this was August of 1944, and this was almost a year before we officially took in the Reinhard Galen spy outfit. I'm going to reread and synopsize some sections from an article that is available on the SpitfireList.com website. In turn, the remarkable book Martin Bormann, Nazi in Exile by Paul Manning, is one of the books available for download on the SpitfireList.com website. There is discussion in this article of the contingency plan by Heinrich Himmler to negotiate a separate peace with the Western Allies and then join with them against the former Soviet Union. I'm not going to read that. It is, however, in the written description for the program, which should be available presently. This article is from Covert Action Information Bulletin from the fall of 1990. This is Covert Action Information Bulletin number 35. It is titled The Secret Treaty of Fort Hunt by Carl Oglesby. After discussing Heinrich Himmler's plan for a separate peace with the Western Allies and then pursuing the war against the Soviet Union in combination with them, there is discussion of the Martin Bormann plan to have basically the Reich go underground. I have spoken about this at great length. Move here. The important link between Martin Bormann and Hermann Schmitz of the decisively important IG Farben chemical cartel. This, the real, not secret, but eclipsed element of Nazism and fascism is that it was an outgrowth of globalization and of the cartel system, which dominated international commerce and really still does. Cartels are basically international monopolies put together by consortia of international transnational corporations, and it is those transnational corporations and their cartel links that are the real decisive element in world affairs today. The U.S. intelligence services and the OSS, predecessor of the CIA, are extensions of that, as discussed in the consummately important book The Old Boys by Burton Hirsch, subtitled The American Elite and the Origins of the CIA. So talking about Martin Bormann, and in particular his links to Hermann Schmitz. But Martin Bormann, who was even more powerful than Himmler, did not accept the premise of the separate peace idea. Bormann was an intimate of Hitler's, the deputy Führer and the head of the Nazi Party, thus superior to Himmler in rank. Bormann wielded additional power as Hitler's link to the industrial and financial cartels that ran the Nazi economy and was particularly close to Hermann Schmitz, chief executive of IG Farben, the giant chemical firm that was Nazi Germany's greatest industrial power. And as we have seen in our many discussions of the remarkable and deadly Bormann Flat Capital Organization, Hermann Schmitz was a decisive element of that. IG Farben was one of the pivotal elements of that, and the three companies coming out of IG Farben, Bayer, Hoechst, and BASF, those companies retained not only the cartel power of IG Farben, but each in and of themselves. Hoechst has since, that's H-O-E-C-H-S-T, has merged and is no longer a separate firm, but they became ultimately even more powerful than IG Farben itself.
You're listening to Dave Emery's For the Record. You can subscribe to the comments posted on the SpitfireList.com website, most of them by a brilliant contributing editor who uses the moniker Terra Fractal. specializing, but by no means exclusively, in economic and financial matters.
Skipping down in this article, and this is by way of review. After the German defeat in the Battle of Normandy in June of 1944, Bormann took the first external steps toward implementing concrete plans for the Nazis' great escape. An enormous amount of Nazi treasure had to be moved out of Europe and made safe. This treasure was apparently divided into several caches, of which the one at the Reichsbank in Berlin included almost 3 tons of gold, much of it the so-called tooth gold from the slaughter camps, as well as silver, platinum, tens of thousands of carats of precious stones, and perhaps $1 billion in various currencies. These were industrial assets to be expatriated. Including large tonnages of specialty steel and certain industrial machinery, as well as blueprints critical for the domination of certain areas of manufacturing. Key Nazi companies needed to be relicensed outside Germany in order to escape the reach of war reparations claims. And tens of thousands of Nazi war criminals, almost all of them members of the SS, needed help to escape Germany and safely regroup in foreign colonies capable of providing security and livelihoods. For help with the first 3 of these tasks, Bormann convened a secret meeting of key German industrialists on August 10, 1944, at the Hotel Maison Rouge in Strasbourg, Alsace-Lorraine. Only the minutes of this meeting One part of the minutes of this meeting states, quote, "The Nazi Party is ready to supply large amounts of money to those industrialists who contribute to the post-war organization abroad. In return, the party demands all financial reserves which have already been transferred abroad or may later be transferred so that after the defeat, a strong new Reich can be built." The Nazi expert in this area was Hitler's one-time financial genius and Minister of the Economy, Dr. Hjalmar Horace Greeley Schacht, available to Bormann even though he was in prison on suspicion of involvement in the anti-Hitler coup of 1944. According to a U.S. Treasury Department report of 1945, at least 750 enterprises financed by the Nazi Party had been set up outside Germany by the end of the war. These firms were capable of generating an annual income of approximately $30 million, all of it available to Nazi causes. It was Schacht's ability to finesse the legalities of licensing and ownership that brought this situation about. One more time, it was Schacht's ability to finesse the legalities of licensing and ownership that brought this situation about. And again, Hjalmar Schacht, a friend of Clay Shaw's. And Clay Shaw was very much involved with Permandex, which brought together the Schroeder banking interests, which had helped to finance the SS, and Alan Dulles. And I'm going to skip down in this article. Bear in mind that this is taking place in August of 1944, as we have seen in For the Record program number 305 about the Bormann Organization. One of the things that was discussed was the importance of certain American corporations in order to help the Nazi flight capital program and the economic resuscitation largely abroad of the Third Reich. One of the firms mentioned was the Hamburg America Line. That was one of the Bush family Nazi businesses. Now, Reinhard Gehlen, we have spoken about him so many times. There is discussion of Reinhard Gehlen in this article. That is the secret treaty of Fort Hunt. And skipping down again. Gehlen became chief of the Third Reich's Foreign Armies East, or Foreign Armies East, on April 1st, 1942. He was thus responsible for Germany's military intelligence operations throughout Eastern Europe and the Soviet Union. His FHO was connected in this role with a number of secret fascist organizations in the countries to Germany's east. These included, note this, Stefan Bandera's B faction of the Organization of Ukrainian Nationalists, or OUNB. The successor organizations to that are currently in power. They hold the police, military, and many of the key governmental reins of power in contemporary Ukraine. Again, these are key elements of the Gehlen spy outfit. His FHO was connected in this role with a number of secret fascist organizations in the countries to Germany's east. These included Stefan Bandera's B faction of the Organization of Ukrainian Nationalists, or OUNB, Romania's Iron Guard, the Ustashi of Yugoslavia, the Vanagis of Latvia, and after the summer of 1942, Vlasov's army, the band of defectors from Soviet communism marching behind former Red Hero General Andrei Vlasov. Later on in the war, Gehlen placed one of his top men in control of Foreign Armies West, which broadened his power, and then after Admiral Wilhelm Canaris was purged, and his Abwehr intelligence organization cannibalized by the SS, Gehlen became, in effect, Nazi Germany's overall top intelligence chief. Now, we've spoken about that, of course, many times, but note that the Bandera OUNB organization, Romanian Iron Guard, the Ustashis of Yugoslavia, and others were key parts of the Gehlen organization. Now note this also, and this also is by way of review, skipping down. A partly declassified CIA document recapitulated in this story in the early 1970s, noting at this time, quote, Gehlen met with Admiral Karl Dönitz, D-O-E-N-I-T-Z, who had been appointed by Hitler as his successor during the last days of the Third Reich. Gehlen and the Admiral were now in a U.S. Army VIP prison camp in Wiesbaden. Gehlen sought and received approval from Dönitz, too. And in a footnote, as Gehlen was about to leave for the U.S., he left a message for Gerhard or Hermann Baum with another of his top aides, Gerhard Wessel. I am to tell you from Gehlen that he has discussed with Hitler's successor, Admiral Karl Dönitz, and Gehlen's superior and chief of staff, General Franz Hager, the question of continuing his work with the Americans. Both were in agreement. And as Carl Oglesby notes, in other words, the German chain of command was still in effect, and it approved of what Gehlen was doing with the Americans. Skipping down. And the whole concept of the deal he was about to offer his conquerors had been approved by a Nazi chain of command that was still functioning, despite what the world thought and still does think was the Nazis' unconditional surrender. One more time. And the whole concept of the deal he was about to offer his conquerors had been approved by a Nazi chain of command that was still functioning despite what the world thought and still does think was the Nazis' unconditional surrender. So note that Galen was basically operating with the approval of and at the behest of, in effect, a Nazi chain of command that was still functioning. And note that his organization included things like the Romanian Iron Guard, the OUNB, those in turn, and the anti-Bolshevik Bloc of Nations, which was originally the Committee of Subjugated Nations formed by Hitler in 1943. Those became key elements of the Republican Party under the auspices of the Crusade for Freedom. More about that later. One of the conditions of the Galen spy organization, and this was agreed to by the U.S., this one of the conditions for its work for the U.S., should the, or this from Oglesby's article, should the organization at any time find itself in a position where the American and German interests diverge, it was accepted that the organization would consider the interests of Germany first. In other words, basically not the U.S., but Germany. Now, we have spoken about the remarkable Bormann organization and the fact that it was headed up by Martin Bormann, who became the head of the Nazi Party in exile, and the security arrangements for and security operations for the Bormann organization were basically supervised by Heinrich Müller, the head of the Gestapo, the SS general in charge of the Gestapo, supposedly died at the end of World War II. When his grave was opened, it was found that there were three corpses inside, none of them the corpse of Heinrich Müller. Of course, Müller escaped from Germany, as did Martin Bormann. And an article from the L.A. Times of February 26th of 2001 by Henry Weinstein, W-E-I-N-S-T-E-I-N, has an interesting title, New Questions Arise on Fate of Gestapo Chief. And according to newly opened files, Heinrich Müller, who, again, did not die in World War II, but actually survived, he went to work for U.S. intelligence after World War II. Again, from the L.A. Times, February 26th of 2001, New Questions Arise on Fate of Gestapo Chief by Henry Weinstein. U.S. Army intelligence records indicate that Müller, who was nicknamed Gestapo Müller to distinguish him from the hundreds of other Müllers in the Nazi hierarchy, was captured by Americans in 1945, says historian George Chaloux, C-H-A-L-O-U, who worked at the National Archives for 28 years. Skipping down. A German television network aired a program based in part on documents from the U.S. National Archives in Maryland, claiming that Müller was captured by the U.S. Army, but released for unknown reasons. Skipping down again. Despite the fact that the files were opened more than 50, that's the files on Müller. Despite the fact that the files on Müller were opened more than 50 years after the end of World War II, numerous portions have been redacted. In February 1999, 8 months before the Army records were made public by the National Archives, Army officials sent Rabbi Heyer of the Wiesenthal Institute a letter saying that some of his requests for information on Müller were being denied on grounds of, quote, national security, unquote, including the possibility that more complete disclosure could compromise intelligence gathering methods. Skipping down again. Index cards stating that Mueller was in custody first in the town of Ilmenau, I-L-M-E-N-A-U, and then in December of 1945 in a civilian internment camp in Altenstadt in Upper Bavaria. It ends with the cryptic and provocative sentence. Case closed, 29th of January, 1946. It is unclear who placed the information on the card, which states that a Mueller dossier was to be sent to Frankfurt. Well, it is more than a little interesting here because, again, Mueller here was apparently quite obviously captured by the Americans, and the files on Mueller were still heavily redacted, or at least portions of them redacted, more than 50 years after World War II on grounds of national security, and saying basically the possibility that more complete disclosure could compromise intelligence gathering methods. That is a very oblique statement, but I think it actually may be accurate in that it not only did Heinrich Mueller go to work as the security director for the Bormann organization, basically a Nazi party gone underground and tied to the corporate cartel links to the Dulleses and Wall Street. But Heinrich Mueller continued to wield very, very important influence with the CIA and the Galen organization. It is in this regard that I think this redaction was actually accurate. It says, including the possibility that more complete disclosure, i.e. about Heinrich Mueller and his captivity by U.S. forces, could compromise intelligence gathering methods. Reading now from Martin Bormann, Nazi in Exile by Paul Manning, from page 211. The Bormann organization had many commercial and political links to the capitals of these three nations, and real clout was available should the chase become too hot. The CIA could have pulled aside the gray curtain that obscured Bormann at any time, but the CIA and Heinrich Mueller's crack organization of former SS men found it to their mutual advantage to cooperate in many situations. There is no morality in the sense that most of us know in the strange world of professional secrecy, and when it was to the advantage of each to work together, they did so. And from page 274, even General Galen, when he was chief of the Federal Republic's intelligence service, sent his agents to confer with General Heinrich Mueller in South America. Again, the Galen organization not only approved by a German chain of command, that was a very Nazi chain of command that was still in effect, but not only did Heinrich Mueller get, quote, captured, unquote, by U.S. forces, but the Mueller/Bormann organization and Galen collaborated with the CIA. And again, more from Martin Bormann, Nazi in Exile. There is lengthy discussion of the surveillance of Paul Manning by Heinrich Mueller's remarkable intelligence outfit. And also there is discussion of how utterly lethal Heinrich Mueller could be, from pages 289 to 290. Israeli agents who move too closely to these centers of Bormann power are eliminated. One such termination was Fritz Bauer, formerly Attorney General for the state of Hesse in Frankfurt a survivor of Auschwitz and the man who tipped off the Israeli Mossad about the presence of Adolf Eichmann in Buenos Aires, who was killed on orders of General Mueller. Mueller's ruthlessness even today is what deters Archer Oxman from offering his testimony that he saw Bormann lying dead on the roadway the night of their escape from the Führer bunker, May 1st to 2nd, 1945. To this day, Oxman, the only so-called living witness to the, quote, death, unquote, of Bormann in Berlin, knows his life is in jeopardy if he reverses himself. General Mueller is thorough and has a long memory, and for a Nazi such as Oxman to go against Mueller's original directive would make him a traitor, and retribution would surely follow. And this, by the way, was, of course, when the book was published in 1981. Mueller is almost certainly, well, I think we can assume he's dead, and Bormann is, but their organization continues, and I believe that it will become the decisive element in human affairs on this planet. I believe ultimately, I think their victory is almost assured now, probably is assured now, and ultimately the Bormann network and the intelligence apparatus under the altogether lethal General Heinrich Mueller will prove to be the decisive element in human affairs on this planet, and I believe the future will be theirs. I have included text from another of the books that is available for download for free on the Spitfire website, The New Germany and the Old Nazis, about the Naumann coup of 1953 and the links between the Naumann coup and the Führungsring. Basically, this was a network of control of Germany by a Nazi government that had gone underground. And this Führungsring was discussed, again, this was the underground, behind-the-scenes control of the German government, the post-war German government, the, quote, new, unquote, Germany, by this Führungsring, described at length not only in AFA 37, but also in a for-the-record program about the Naumann coup attempt. In September of 1950, the Nazi headquarters in Madrid, Spain, issued a circular letter. And again, it was this Nazi headquarters in Spain that was administering the Führungsring, which controlled the, quote, new, unquote, government in Germany. Again, there is discussion of this in numerous programs, and I have included the text about the Naumann coup attempt and the Führungsring in the written description for this program that will become available presently.
You're listening to Dave Emery's For the Record. All of Dave Emery's 36 years of work is available for download on the SpitfireList.com website. The site includes many articles not included in the programs, as well as a small library of old anti-fascist books. All of the material on the website is available for free. Sister station WFMU is podcasting the For the Record programs. To subscribe to the podcast, use the link at the top of the description for this program or on the front page.
Of the Führungsring. Besides the infiltration of co-conspirators into positions of command within the existing parties and into government departments and party organizations on the middle and lower levels, another task of the Führungsring was to organize and direct mass organizations such as veterans and refugee associations, which one day could easily be used as instruments for political action. Other fields of activities for the group were political propaganda in foreign countries, carried out in close contact with the Nazi headquarters in Madrid, and the initiation of conspiracies in foreign countries on behalf of German industrial cartels, i.e. the Bormann Organization. This lengthy document, issued in September of 1950, spoke of the total failure of the Western occupation policy and pointed gleefully to the success of the, quote, flexible and smoothly working organization which, at the end of the war, provided the precondition for all the gains that by necessity emerged for Germany out of the chaos of the post-war period, unquote. 5 years after Potsdam, we can look back with pride at our accomplishments. Nothing happened by chance. Everything was carefully planned. There is considerable material available which gives conclusive proof that the Nazis had made preparation long before their collapse to train an army of agents, often skillfully camouflaged as resistance fighters. About the success, that by the way, is T.H. Petten's writing. The previous quote was from a Nazi circular letter. Continuing. About the successful continuation of the Nazi subversive activities, the Madrid circular letter had this to say, quote, even after the collapse, the National Socialist Party continued to work in a camouflaged way in dozens of seemingly innocuous societies and groups in order to keep the national outlook of the German people alive and undiluted. Just as many small brooks go toward making a mighty stream, the various nationalistic and radical groups in the Zonenreich carried out almost without exception worthwhile and powerful propaganda. Each of these groups had its special task and had to adjust its work to certain situations and circumstances. However, it was of chief importance to direct the underlying trend of the patriotic propaganda toward the same goal. The more diverse and disconnected these groups appeared on the surface, the less they were apt to arouse suspicion that they were directed and influenced by a central organization. We have placed our confidential agents, observers, and representatives for special assignments in all parties, even among communist organizations and their fronts. The greater the number of organizations controlled and influenced by this, the more effective will be the results of our work. He was against the background of the Galen organization, against the background of the Führungsring that was running Germany, against the background of the Underground Reich, as I call it, the Bormann organization, and the deadly Heinrich Müller intelligence apparatus, which worked with the CIA and with Galen, that the following needs to be considered. This is from the book Destiny Betrayed by Jim DiGenio, copyright 1992, and 2012 by Skyhorse Publishing, about Clay Shaw. The next step in the CIA ladder after his high-level overseas informant service was his work with a strange company called Permindex. When the announcement for Permindex was first made in Switzerland in late 1956, its principal backing was to come from a local banker named Hans Seligman. But as more investigation by the local papers was done, it became clear that the real backer was J. Henry Sugar Corporation. This information was quite revealing. Schroeder's had been closely associated with Alan Dulles and the CIA for years. Alan Dulles' connections to the Schroeder banking family went back to the 30s when his law firm Sullivan and Cromwell first began representing them through him. Later, Dulles was the bank's general counsel. In fact, when Dulles became CIA director, Schroeder's was a repository for a $50 million contingency fund that Dulles personally controlled. Schroeder's was a welcome conduit because the bank benefited from previous CIA overthrows in Guatemala and Iran. Another reason that there began to be a fear over Permanex in Switzerland was the fact that the bank's founder, Baron Kurt von Schroeder, was associated with the Third Reich, specifically Heinrich Himmler. The project now became stalled in Switzerland. It now moved to Rome. In a September 1969 interview Shaw did for Penthouse magazine, he told James Phelan that he only grew interested in the project when it moved to Italy, which was in October of 1958. Yet a State Department cable dated April 9th of that year says that Shaw showed great interest in Permanbex from the outset. One can see why. The board of directors was made up of bankers who had been tied up with fascist governments, people who worked the Jewish refugee racket during World War II, a former member of Mussolini's cabinet, and the son-in-law of Hjalmar Schacht, the economic wizard behind the Third Reich, who was a friend of Clay Shaw's. These people would all appeal to the conservative Shaw. And again, there are other connections to Permanbex and Clay Shaw. But note Hjalmar Schacht's role. We're going to come back to him in our next show. His links to the Dulleses, his work, according to Oglesby, in helping to arrange for the Borman Flight Capital Network. Also, from Destiny Betrayed by Jim DiGiamio. In Chapter 1, the author introduced Freeport Sulfur and its subsidiaries Moa Bay Mining and Nicaro Nickel. These companies all had large investments in Cuba prior to Castro's revolution, and this ended up being one of the ways that Garrison connected Clay Shaw and David Ferry. This came about for two reasons. First, with Castro taking over their operations in Cuba, Freeport was attempting to investigate bringing in nickel ore from Cuba through Canada, which still had trade relations with Cuba. The ore would then be refined in Louisiana, either at a plant already in New Orleans or another plant in Braithwaite. And again, David Ferry involved with these flights. We are going to talk more about Freeport Sulfur, about Hjalmar Schacht, about the Dulleses, and about many of these links in our next program. However, we are all out of time. This concludes For the Record program number 1058, The Christian West, Part 1, Contextual Foundation of the Jim DiGiamio Interviews. This is being recorded on February 26th of 2019. I'm Dave Emery. Have fun.